Dr. Kovors, thank you so much for joining us on the call today. We really appreciate it. We know you have a very busy schedule. You teach a lot. You have a full-time practice. So we very much appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us.
I give the thank you back. Thank you for inviting me. It's an honor.
Oh, our pleasure. So, you know, I thought perhaps I would start by speaking a little bit about your relationship with George Fotoukas. You know, for me, George is one of the greatest masters of homeopathy who's ever lived. And I remember actually many years ago having a dinner in the Netherlands with Roger Morrison and Nancy Herrick. And I was very new to homeopathy. This is probably about 22 years ago. And I asked them what they thought of George Fotoukas. And I remember Roger pausing and then saying to me, you know, if Hahnemann were alive today, he would be in total awe of George Fotoukas. And I'll never forget that statement because it just completely blew my mind. And the more that I've studied George's Materia Medica and his writings on the philosophy and practice of homeopathy, this has been completely confirmed to me in my own practice. So I'm curious, for yourself, what is it specifically that you find so beneficial in George's teachings?
Well, let me speak a few words about my personal history, because I was studying not directly medicine. I first studied civil engineer, then I studied naturopathy for 2 years, and then I went into medicine. All the time, it started since 1977. All the times I was, the idea behind was to understand what is disease and how comes disease and how disease is connected to the health of the people. And through all these years where I was studying naturopathy, medicine, I was disappointed because no one could give me an explanation. And this lasted till the year 2000, I think the end of 2000. I was sitting in a video course of George Fotoukas for the first time. Some person had invited me to go there. And my lower jaw was hanging down because I was not understanding how a man could answer my questions, which I had for more than 23 years, without seeing me, without me being able to ask even. So I was, after this weekend, it was the weekend, Saturday, Sunday, on Monday, my prescription and my homeopathic practice were better already. It's unbelievable. So what for me George Fotoukas represents in this time is, of course, the connection to Hahnemann, which I'm, of course, proud of because I'm German, half Greek. You can understand, though. Hahnemann was really an exceptional spirit. And I think George represents very clearly his thinking and especially a very strong clarity in the thinking. This is the one thing. The other thing is that his teaching, and for me, he's a very good teacher. His teaching is very structured, and it's so good because he has so much experience. So what he talks about is not some fantasies. It's always what he has been experiencing over the years. And that makes it easy to understand, and that makes it easy to bring it to your practice and to your clinic and to apply it on your patients. And then, the first time I heard about the levels of health, and I don't know whether all our listeners are familiar with that. So the levels of health is a model which shows the strength of the immune system, which gives an incredible help to your clinic to see about the prognosis of a case, to see how the reaction should be in a correct remedy. There are many, many applications, and one of these applications is what we are going to talk about today, is concerning the acute diseases. So I was really, I could not believe that somebody exists in this world who has all these explanations for the questions I was looking for 23 years.
Fantastic. I'm just curious, the video course, the videos that are presented, are they the cases that he's doing right now, or these are the cases that he has that are his cases that he has, you know, had from the past. What is he actually doing in the video course? Could you tell us?
Actually, that's a very good question. Thank you for that, Kim. So it's like he had three parts. One, and I'm teaching the video course in I'm moderating the video course in London and in Alonissus together with George, which is a big honor for me, of course. And it has three parts. One part is theory, which has all the the basic theory of understanding and of how applying homeopathy. The second part is materia medica, where he gives clear information and the essential information for about 135 remedies. And the third part is cases. And the cases are mostly from the last, let's say, about 15 years, with many, many follow-ups. So this is, for me, this is an example for a structural teaching which has all what a student needs to get to a certain level and to be able to apply homeopathy. Yeah. So I regard this educational program as a very good program for as well as for the beginners, as well as for advanced homeopaths, because many of them don't know this kind of theory, these explanations which really help in practice. So in my class in Alonissus, for example, I had people who were studying homeopathy for 17 years, and still they had made a lot of progress during the 3 years program.
Fantastic. Yorgos, I'd like to switch subjects. I know that the title of the conference that you're offering in Toronto,
yes,
is the treatment of infectious diseases, and I know that you've worked a lot on specifically focusing on acute diseases, viral and pandemics, things along that line. I'm curious, what are the challenges, the specific challenges that you have found in treating acute diseases now in current times?
Yeah, we have first to see what medical school or classical medicine, what kind of problems they face. There are two the major groups of are the bacteria and the virus diseases. So what we see in the bacteria is that we see more and more resistant bacteria. So resistant that there are some strains like Acinetobacter, for example, a gram-negative bacteria, which there's only one antibiotic or even none that can be applied or can help in this disease from the classical side. So this means if you have a patient like this, they sometimes have to close intensive care units because they cannot do anything about that. And everybody, of course, knows the MRSA, the methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, which is going through the newspapers in all the countries. So we have a lot of resistant against bacteria, which, of course, are self-created. This they know, and they say it. So they are self-created because by giving antibiotics, and we will talk about this, you will change eventually the level of health. Mean decrease in level of health means at the same time that you are susceptible for other kind of bacteria. Let's say the Staphylococcus aureus, the normal Staphylococcus aureus, not the multi-resistant one. So we have in the levels of health, we have four groups, and we have 12 levels. So the normal Staphylococcus aureus, for example, has resonance more with the lower group 1 or upper group 2. This means people who are, their immune system is quite strong, they tend to get, for example, Staphylococcus aureus infections, or even higher, they get Streptococcus infections, for example, like scarlet fever. So when we treat all the population like it was being treated in the last 80 years, or especially in the last 50 years, with a lot of antibiotics, cortisone, and so on, and a lot of stresses, then their level of health goes down, and we're facing other bacteria which have resonance to these groups. And what is amazing is that the lower you get in terms of groups, and you get other bacteria, there you find more resistant bacteria. And this is what is the challenge of our time. So, and the second one is, of course, the virus infections. Everybody knows now that we have some virus infections which threatens mankind. So we had, all the experts are waiting for a pandemic. So the viruses, the same development, the virus is getting more and more virulent, especially because their hosts, the immune system of their hosts is more and more compromised. And the virostatic medication very, very quickly, there is a resistance in the virus very quickly developing. So this means, for example, the Tamiflu would have 90% resistance in the so-called Mexican flu, what we had last year, for example, or even this year. Yeah. So these are the challenges. And now comes, what can homeopathy do about this? Homeopathy can help the patient in any situation if you are good enough to find the remedy. This means we try to raise the level of health. The moment we raise the level of health, the organism is able to defend himself against the bacteria or the virus. I remember a very funny story, because I was teaching here in Erlangen College, the Faculty of Medicine, for 5 terms. And, of course, it went well for 5 terms. And then the dean of the university, he attacked me. He attacked classical homeopathy. He attacked my teacher. He attacked me personally. And one of his arguments we telephoned was that he cannot imagine how a homeopathic remedy could stop the replication of a virus. Of course it cannot stop the replication of a virus. Of course not. No, but it can strengthen the health of the person, and by that the immune system is able to defend the virus, to defeat the virus.
Very interesting. Yorgos, you mentioned earlier levels of health, and I'm curious, is there a connection between the levels of health and infectious diseases in general?
Yes, it's what I mentioned already a little bit, is that the different levels of health have different types of acutes, and not only that, they have also different types of bacteria and viruses. Let's make a simple example. See the children which have scarlet fever. You know that Hahnemann himself was one of his main ideas when he started to potentize remedies was the scarlet fever epidemic in Königslutter in 1799. Where he was very successful in treating scarlet fever. And the main remedy, and almost the only remedy, was belladonna. Why is that? It's because many of his patients belonged to group 1 at that time. This means that group 1 has a strong susceptibility for streptococcus, and especially the ones who create scarlet fever. Because the organism is very strong and the bacteria is the same, the remedy which will counteract or will help the organism to counteract the scarlet fever will be in many, many cases the same. This means the more you go down in the groups, the more variety of possibilities of remedies you get. So this was so clear to the extent that he made, I know it's not really a prophylaxis, but he gave in families where one child had scarlet fever, he gave belladonna to the rest of the family, or especially to the children, because it had a high lethality. I don't remember, 15% to 20%. So he avoided by this that the other children would get scarlet fever. But it was, this is a big misunderstanding in homeopathy. This is not a prophylaxis. They had to take belladonna, like C30, every day, which means that the moment the child was developing, wanted to develop the symptomatology of belladonna, belladonna was already there, strengthened the symptoms for a short time, and then cured the scarlet fever without breaking out. This means it's not a prophylaxis, it's a therapy of the first minute. Do you understand that?
Sure.
Yeah. So this is why all these crazy ideas came into homeopathy, that it's possible to make a prophylaxis, which I think is a wrong idea. Hahnemann never has said that, and it won't work. Why it does not work? Because the possibility of the patient, for example, in malaria, we have seen in England, the whole thing started because some people said that it's possible to make a homeopathic vaccination. I even, it's difficult for me to speak these words. Homeopathic vaccination against malaria. Why it's not possible? Because malaria can create a lot of pictures of remedies, like China sulfurica, like natrium muriaticum. There are so many possibilities. Only if you know which remedy this organism would develop, which picture of which remedy would develop, then you could give it all the time, and then it would help. This is the only condition.
Right. Yeah, and actually, to further your argument, that wasn't there another outbreak of scarlet fever, I think maybe 3 years later, and then the genus epidemicus then was no longer belladonna, but I believe it was aconite at that point. So that,
correct,
I think, further confirms what,
yeah,
you're saying, basically.
But you see how successful, Hahnemann was so successful that even the Prussian government at that time recommended a very low dilution of belladonna as a prophylaxis. So they saw, and I think Hahnemann gave very convincing examples how homeopathy can cure, because he in his lifetime he was facing three epidemics. One was the scarlet fever, the second one was the so-called typhoid fever at 1813 after the Battle of Leipzig, and there he was very successful. He had a cure of more than 99% of his patients, whereas the allopaths at that time had a lethality of 15%. And the third one, very well known, is the cholera epidemic, which was in 1831, where the lethality was 50%, and the homeopaths were in between 1 to, I don't know, there are exact statistics, I think 1 to 4% of lethality in such a severe... and now I have to tell you a funny story. I was invited in Sweden some years before, and there was a Swedish professor who is, of course, the arch enemy of homeopathy in Sweden. I don't want to mention his name, but all the Swedish listeners will know. So he said, as an argument, it's known that the homeopaths had these successes in cholera epidemic, and even Hahnemann could predict which are the remedies that will come, which are the remedies that have this symptomatology. And he said, listen now, in cholera, it's known that you can lose between 10 to 15 liters of liquid per day. And this is why you go to dehydration, to collapse, and then you die finally. And he said, it's unbelievable, huh? He said it's because of the water they drink and they dilute the remedy because they survive.
Right.
You cannot drink 10 liters of liquid. It's impossible. Nobody can do that.
Right.
So you see, the arguments are so stupid. Huh?
Yeah, really. Amazing. Yorgos, you kind of touched on this a little bit a few moments ago about the fact that we're seeing, you know, more serious types of infections, viral infections. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Just,
why they're becoming more frequent and severe in what we see today?
Yes, thank you for this question also. So the problem is that you see very clearly with the so-called Mexican flu. The viruses, and this is our Paramyxa viridae, this is the strain, this is the family, they are very easy to make shifts. So they can change their genetic character quite easily. And what we are doing, what classical medicine is doing is very counterproductive, because they do two things. They give antiviral drugs, which means, which also from an allopathic point of view, you should keep them back for the severe cases. You should hold them back for the severe cases and then apply them. This would be rational. But what they do, you have seen in the bird flu epidemic, they have taken it in advance. So taking it advance gives the virus the chance of adapting his genetic material to that. So giving the virostatics or the antiviral drugs create a pressure on the virus to make more easy shifts. This is the one thing. And the other thing is the vaccination, which does exactly the same, because the virus comes to a body which has some antibodies. He may change, develop another shape, and he will be resistant against this vaccination. This is what we see every year. This is why we have to vaccinate. They vaccinate every year because of these shifts. So this means the two main measures that were taken in against the Mexican flu, both of them were giving a pressure on the virus to make shifts. And during the shifts, there is the possibility, of course, of shifting from a harmless virus to a killer virus, like the 1918 virus, you see. So the measures of classical medicine, not even from a homeopathic point of view, just from a rational point of view, are counterproductive. And they create more and more strains of viruses which are eventually taking such a shape that the organism has a lot of problem with them.
Incredible. Yorgos, this is obvious. This is kind of an obvious question, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Why do you feel that homeopathy is superior to allopathic treatment in addressing these types of acute conditions?
Yeah, first of all, it's our history which shows clearly that in many, many epidemics, homeopathic prescribing was the only medicine to help people. Like I have said, the cholera and other epidemics too. So what the superiority of homeopathy is, of course, the individual prescribing and the fact that the remedies themselves do not weaken the system. For example, in the 1918 Spanish flu, the so-called Spanish flu, which had a lethality in between 15% to 30%, they were provide at that time the drug they were giving was aspirin. So they give acetyl salicylic acid. And after a while, they found out, the classical physicians found out that the people who got the aspirin were dying easier. Why they were dying easier? It's very, very simple. Because this suppresses the fever, and the fever is one of the main weapons against the flu. So the few cases that died in homeopathic hands, which were less than 1%, they found out were those cases that had been taking aspirin before and have weakened their defenses.
Interesting.
So this means homeopathy is not only does not harm in this precarious situation, this very difficult situation, but it also takes care of the exact symptomatology of the patient. And by strengthening the symptomatology, all we know that, there comes a cure, even in such severe diseases with such a high letality we had in 1918. And of course, there is no development of resistance against homeopathic remedies. Not possible.
Sure.
Another advantage.
So, Yorgos, you know, the 1918 flu epidemic, which you mentioned, you know, killed
yes.
a very large number of people. People don't realize how many people actually died during that epidemic. And that was during a period of time when the world population was significantly smaller than it is now. There are many people who, you know, there are many reports out there about the possibility of pandemics that could, you know, even comparable to what happened in the middle 14th century with the Black Plague, when, you know, literally a third of the population of Europe was wiped out, half the parishes were eliminated. So I'm curious, do you feel that there is a risk today of another type of pandemic, either comparable to what happened in 1918 or even similar to what might have happened in the middle 14th century? What is your feeling about this?
Well, there is definitely a danger. And, of course, I hope we can pray that it will not happen. Because although we know that homeopathy can do something, we have to face the situation that at that time, when in 1918, many, many people, and it was interesting because at that time it was mostly in young adults in between 20 to 35. So the main people who were had severe infections were in this age. These were people which were statistically quite high in the levels of health. This was the reason, like I mentioned earlier, that there was only two main remedies. There were two main remedies. The one was, I don't know whether you know, but one was bryonia, and the other was gerzenium. With these two remedies, I don't know, 80 to 90% of the cases were treated successfully. And there were a few other remedies. But this means that the health of these people was quite good. Now, if we would have a pandemic now, situation would be much more difficult, because the variety of possible remedies would be much bigger. And this is one of the reasons I give these infectious disease seminars. Actually, this idea came for me because I felt helpless myself. I saw how good were the old masters in prescribing on acute situations. And I said, okay, I have to learn and have to study acute situations much more. I have to go to know and to differentiate in fever conditions, all the remedies, and so on. So the idea is that the homeopaths must be quite good trained to take that challenge. And then what I'm fearing that there are not enough good trained homeopaths at the time such a pandemic would break out.
So are you familiar with the Thomas Bradford's book on the law of figures, where he talks a little bit about the mortality rate in the treatment of epidemics in the late 19th century with allopaths versus homeopaths? And because that, to me, is always very interesting, because he kind of documents statistically the efficacy of homeopathy versus the allopathic treatment. And I don't remember the exact figures, but it's quite a difference. It's like the conventional doctors had like between 40, 50, 60% mortality rates, and the good homeopaths, the well-trained Hahnemannian homeopaths, had somewhere like anywhere between, you know, 3 to 5% mortality rates. And then there were, of course, people like Adolf Lippe, who, you know, in whatever, 50 years of medical practice, never lost one type.
He was one of the best prescribers.
Yeah, I mean, I think the report is in 50 years, he never lost one typhoid, cholera, or malaria case. So my question to you is, what kind of training is required for us to be able to replicate that type of success? Because I think you're right, there's a very good chance that we could have a pandemic, and we're going to need very qualified practitioners out there to be able to effectively address it.
Yes, what we need to have is written in the organon already. So we need to have we have to have the symptoms. We have to have knowledge of the remedies, but not a raw knowledge. We have to know the remedies very good, and then we have to know the theory how to apply. So let's say, applied on an acute epidemic, you know, all the old masters had this knowledge. Like Lippe was a famous prescriber. He really, like you said, he lost no patient. It's unbelievable. So they had this knowledge where they knew to prescribe on one, two, or three symptoms. And of course, you need to have a medical knowledge to differentiate in the symptoms, to know which are the most leading symptoms, which remedies you could expect, which remedies you could think of in that or that situation. This is why, for example, I give my clinical seminars where I try to, for example, in a pneumonia, I try to differentiate what is a bryonia pneumonia, what is a lycopodium, a chelidonium, a Seneca pneumonia, what are the characteristics? It's but a few symptoms you have to know in order to differentiate. So we need to be trained, and this was really for me, this is a challenge for me, so to make myself being better, because I could solve a lot of my chronic cases, but I saw sometimes in some acute cases, I was a little bit helpless. This brought me to the idea of this, of my clinical seminars, like where I combine clinical knowledge with medical knowledge and with the differentiating of the homeopathic remedy in acute situations.
Interesting. Yorgos, what about the relationship between acute diseases and chronic ones? How do you see that relationship?
Well, George Mitsoulkas has written very good about this. He calls it, first of all, he calls it continuum of diseases. This means that in a certain patient, you have a certain history where you can, if you take the case, you can see how the development of the disease was in this specific organism. This is very interesting. It was one of the questions I could never understand when I studied naturopathy and later medicine. So the point is that the acute diseases are different from level to level to level, especially in between the groups. This means that the two higher groups, group 1 and group 2, they are prone to have acute diseases. Then there comes like a break to group 3 and 4, where acute diseases are very rare, and if they occur, they can be quite serious, like we see in MRSA infections in intensive care units. So this means that we have a shift, again, a shift downwards through our advanced medicine. People are, if people are treated only symptom-wise, like classical medicine doing that, it seems, like Hahnemann has described that already, seems that the immune system is going down. At a certain point, they lose the ability of producing an acute. If we say acute, we mean to produce a strong reaction in an organism which has like more than 39 degrees of fever. So this ability is lessened, you go down. And then there comes a stage, you go from acute diseases, where you are prone to have a lot of acute diseases, which in group 2, for example, you go through a subacute phase, maybe, to a chronic state. And this fact is now acknowledged also by medical school. They found this sequence. This is a sequence, acute, subacute, chronic. And this is where we homeopaths do our work. You and me, every day, we try to bring people back from group 3, where most of our people already are there in so-called civilized countries, bring them back from group 3 to group 2 by helping them producing fever again. At the same time, it shows that the chronic disease will fade.
Yorgos,
you're going to stop me because I can talk for hours.
No, I don't know when you're finished. But if my question to you is, as you know, there's the whole history of relationship of remedies, starting with Bunninghausen's concordances in his 1846 pocketbook. Do you pay much attention to the relationship of remedies when, like, for example, you've given the what they call the constitutional or chronic remedy to the patient, and then they develop an acute later on? Are you looking towards relationship of remedies, or that's not something you pay much attention to in your practice?
Of course. You find so often complementary remedies. You find so often the sequence of remedies. You find remedies which are related. This is a tremendous help, especially in acute, where you have so little, so few symptoms, and you have a case, for example, from Bryonia, which is going to be restless, and you see a picture of Rastocks developing. Mm-hmm. So, of course, this knowledge is very, very important. I just want to come back to this idea of the clinical seminars. So I had dedicated myself a few years before, I think it was in 2005, to make a series of clinical seminars, which everyone is has one subject. Like, for example, one is a lung, I call it lung seminar. It's a pulmonologic seminar, which shows all the acute in pulmonology, like, for example, pneumonias, like bronchitis, like different diseases. And then I start to teach the medical knowledge, to teach the symptoms, because all of us have forgotten what we have learned earlier, me included, of course, and then show which remedies apply to the symptomatology. Huh. And I found out that the students are very attracted by this idea, because they have already learned the materia medica, but they cannot differentiate easily between the remedies in a certain situation, because they don't know, chelidonium has cold fingertips, for example, can be a symptom, or have the pain, more known pain in the right shoulder. So there you can differentiate the remedies. It is of a tremendous help in this. So I have dedicated to this idea, and I have created already six of the seminars. One is lung disease, one is heart disease. This infectious disease seminar I'm giving in Toronto is also one. I have a pediatric pediatric seminar, otorhinolaryngology seminar, and a gastroenterologic seminar, which is my new one. So every year I try to finish one new, which is a lot of work for me, because I read through all the old masters, I go to all the sources. But I have dedicated myself in order to teach myself and then to teach my students.
Yorgos, could you tell us specifically the seminar in Toronto? What are you hoping that the students will come away with from participating?
So the seminar in Toronto has two main points. The one is that I will give an introduction in the video course of George with some part of his theory connected, of course, again to the infectious diseases. And this is one part. And the other part is, the main part is, that I will talk about infectious disease. Many of these things we have talked in the last 40 minutes. And teach to differentiate remedies, for example, in the flu, for example, in the pneumonia, but, for example, in many, many other, like, another example is, for example, we say a lot, don't vaccinate. Yes, okay, we don't vaccinate. But who of us has experience of treating a diphtheria? You have to go back to the old masters and see how they treat, how successful they were. So there are certain remedies for that, and you have to study these remedies. And this is the knowledge I try to give in my clinical seminars, to make us feel better when we have this challenge. If we say to the people, no, don't vaccinate for diphtheria, but what do you do then if you have a case? How you recognize, how you treat.
Yorgos, I'd like to open it up and let some other people ask some questions. I'm sure, you know, because this has been a very engaging discussion, and you brought up some very fascinating and very interesting points. I actually would love to participate in one of your seminars. So I'd like to open it up and let some other people ask some questions. But before I do that, I just wanted to give some information for people to access. First of all, Dr. Kavouras' website is www.kavouras.de, and I'll spell that out for you. So www.kavouras.de. That's David Elephant, and that's for Deutsch. So www.kavouras.de, and you can go to his website, and he's got a lot of very interesting information, and you can find out more about Dr. Kavouras there and also his upcoming clinical seminars. He actually has one on October 3rd in Freudenstadt, Germany, on specifically on the subject of levels of health. And then October 6th through 10th is his Vitalkus video course. That's in London. October 18th through the 19th, he's in Tel Aviv, where he's offering one of his clinical seminars on lung and infectious diseases. And then October 30th through the 31st is the one in Toronto entitled Infectious Diseases and Levels of Health. And, of course, as he mentioned, there'll be a little bit of an introduction with George Vitalkus' video stuff. Now, Yorgos, if somebody wants to go to the website or find out more information about the seminar in Toronto, how would they do that? Is there a web page they can go and visit, or a phone number they can call?
Yes, I think there is. I think there is information there to how to book the seminar and how to get to participate in the seminar. And what I want to mention, I'm in the process of developing my website, and who is interested? I think in the next 2 months I will establish a newsletter possibility, so somebody who then comes to my website can click on the newsletter, so I will be keeping people informed about my latest activities and my upcoming seminars.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I think anyway people can go to the website for Riverdale Books, which I guess
yes.
Google. And then I guess there'll be all the information about the seminar in Toronto and also information about how to sign up for it. So unless you have something else you'd like to add, I think I'll just go ahead and open it up and let some other people ask some questions. Is that okay, or did you want to say something additional?
No, I just thank the people for listening. And
It was very erudite and very wonderful conversation. So hold on 1 second, and I'll open up the line. So does anybody have any questions for Dr. Kavouras?
Yes, I do.
Go ahead. What's your name, first of all?
Yeah, this is Farnoosh from Vancouver.
Okay. Go ahead and ask.
Hi, Dr. Kavouras. Thank you for your time. My question is, have you ever thought about or used different potencies of the constitutional remedy for the acute cases rather than going to the complementary remedies?
Can you repeat the question?
I'm going to mute the line out because there's a little bit of background noise, but her question was, do you ever find, like you found the person's constitutional remedy, and then they develop some type of an acute situation, do you ever find that you will give the same constitutional remedy during the acute, or do you always give a different remedy which is perhaps complementary to the constitutional?
Actually, this is a very good question. I always answer at any of my clinical seminars as a first point. So there's two possibilities. The one possibility is that a person from whom we know the constitutional remedy already, and he maybe has been in treatment or not, through the acute, maybe a pneumonia, stays with his constitutional remedy. For example, he's a lycopodium, and he develops a lycopodium pneumonia. He's a phosphorus, he develops a phosphorus pneumonia. This is one possibility. The second possibility is that during the acute, and it happens quite often in pneumonia, and especially in people whose health is not belonging, the strength of the immune system not belonging to group one, we see that during the acute, a picture of another remedy will come. For example, like in the constitutional lycopodium, he will develop a bryonia pneumonia. So what is interesting now, you have to give the bryonia. The lycopodium will not help in this situation. The bryonia takes away the symptomatology, and maybe afterwards you may need the lycopodium to finish the cure.
that answer your question, or did you have another question you wanted to ask about that? Okay, well, we'll move on. Other questions for Dr. Kavouras?
Yeah, hi, Yorgos. It's Karen Gunta in Toronto.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine.
I just wanted to tell everybody that I've attended Yorgos' seminars, and they're really, really amazing, and I would definitely recommend it. Unfortunately, I won't be able to make it. We're going on vacation at the same time, but I highly recommend his work. It's so fascinating, everything from Vitulkas, and Yorgos has a wonderful way of teaching it. I can't recommend it enough.
Great. And Karen, did you want to ask a question too, or just...
No, I just wanted to
okay.
that message.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Other questions for Dr. Kavouras? Don't be shy. This, you know, we don't oftentimes have the opportunity to speak to somebody of the caliber of Dr. Kavouras, who has his type of clinical background and his understanding of homeopathy. So this is really a great opportunity for all of you on the call today. So don't be shy.
Actually, Yorgos, it's Karen again. Just wondering, are you going to repeat these seminars, or you just do it once?
I understood the question this time. So actually, I repeat them because there is always the need, but I repeat them in different countries. Sometimes I come back to the same country with the same seminar because these seminars are like my children.
Yeah.
They develop. So the information gets more complete, more differentiated with my personal growth. So I like really to repeat them, because even if somebody has seen it once, he may like to see it a second time. And I'm glad in Germany now my seminars are taped, and so one can even listen in your house, but not yet in English. It's just in German. So you would have to learn German for that.
Okay, well, as long as they're repeated, that's great to know, because if you
yes,
miss one, then you're not totally out. Great.
Well, I think, though, Karen, he said that he might not offer the same seminar in Toronto necessarily, so... You might have to travel to a different location to get that the one on infectious diseases again.
Yeah, or you just have to
wait until I make it again in Toronto. So there will be a cycle of seminars, new ones and old ones. I repeat, because there's a lot of people like you who ask for a repetition of the old seminars.
Yeah, they're vital. They're really vital to homeopath knowledge for sure. Mm-hmm.
Great. So we still have a few minutes. We have about 4 or 5 minutes left. So if anybody has any questions, please feel free to ask them.
Yes, I do. This is Margaret from New York. Dr. Kavouras, I loved your session. I just wondered, what age would you start? Like, if you had a baby, like 12 months old, that's very small, would you treat her for lack of development at this stage, or would you wait?
You know what, Mark, can you repeat that question? Because I couldn't hear it, and I'm assuming that...
Yeah, I couldn't hear either.
Could you repeat it a little bit louder?
Yes. The question was, if you had a baby, 12 months old, who was very small, she appears very healthy, but is extremely small, would you start to treat her, or would you wait until she was older? And if you did treat her, what potency would you use?
Kim, I didn't understand.
Did you get the question that time?
A 12-month-old baby, and then I didn't understand, which is not...
Oh, yeah, the question. The question was, you have a 12-month-old baby, one-year-old baby, and the baby is healthy, but it's smaller than normal. It's not as large as a baby that a year-old should be. And she didn't qualify in terms of how much smaller, but smaller than normal. And so the question is, would you treat that baby, or would you maybe just assume it was a developmental issue, or maybe just that was the makeup of the baby? And if you would treat them, what potency would you use?
Okay, so this question arises a lot of things at the same time. So if a baby is small, you have to look to the parents. Huh? If the parents are small, maybe it's normal. The second thing is that, unfortunately, in our times, many of our children have predispositions. So we collect, at this age of mankind, we collect predispositions. So almost every child which is born has predispositions. So I think that it's a good idea to treat all of our children. And even if they are healthy, you may avoid that predispositions may come on later. And for the potency, the potency is related also to the levels of health. So normally the children are of better health than are the adults. So normally you can go quite high, especially if the remedy is clear. If the remedy is not clear in a child, we used to give a C200, which is a really good potency to see a reaction. I try to answer shortly because I could talk.
No, that's fine. Yorgos, are you using the C potencies exclusively, or do you also use the LMs, the Q potencies? And also, do you give the remedies only in dry dose, or do you sometimes put them in liquid and, you know, succuss, like the way they describe it in the fifth edition of the Organon, the sixth edition? I'm curious, what do you use as...
Yes, good question. I'm most familiar with the C potencies. In Germany, we have a lot of D potencies as well. I use them. I have used the Q potencies in the past a lot. I have left it a little bit because I have seen the C potencies are working sometimes deeper and more reliable. But I think you can treat with any of these potencies as long as you are familiar with their action. And normally I give tripotencies in chronic cases. In acute cases, I let them take in the liquid form because we have seen that it works stronger and more prompt, more quickly.
Very good. I actually have another question, then I'll open it back up to the lines. My other question is, I interviewed a number of people over the years who argued that when you're treating acute diseases, you have to be much more precise in your remedy prescription, that you don't have a lot of leeway. You would expect to see a very rapid response, of course, but you have to be very exact with the remedy prescription. Whereas in chronic disease treatment, there's maybe more remedies that can affect or move the case in the direction of cure. And I'm curious what your opinion is about that particular position.
This is a strange question. I have never heard this, but it's a very good question. So, in my belief, there is always only one possibility. The difference in between the acute and the chronic state is that in the acute, you see much earlier, in most of the cases, whether the remedy was correct or not. In the chronic case, it's sometimes very difficult to see it in the first few days, in the first week. Sometimes you have to wait 4 weeks, sometimes 6 weeks in rare cases where you see the action. But I believe that also the chronic cases, they carry only one remedy. It means you have to give one remedy at one time. And then maybe you have a possibility after some time to see a second remedy. But at one time, I believe there's only one remedy that can help.
Okay, good. Let me go ahead and open. I think we have a couple more minutes, so we might have time for one or two more questions. Let me go ahead and... Anybody
Hello?
Else have a question for Dr. Kervoris?
Yes, I have one.
Go ahead. What's your name, please?
My name is Yannis Tamou. I'm calling from Thessaloniki, Greece. Yasu Yorgo.
Okay.
Yasu Yannis.
My question is this. I would like to ask George's opinion about this phenomenon. We know that when a patient belongs to group D, he very rarely develops acute or never develops an acute. But we see when this patient with a very severe disease or a very ruined health, with the defense mechanism damaged, when he reaches the stage just before death, he develops high fever, and then he dies. I would like to George to give us an explanation about this phenomenon, how a person of this group, of this low level of health, can develop this kind of fever, and if this fever can be treated homeopathically or not.
Okay, I understood the question. Thank you for this very good question, Yanis. Actually, it is like this. I said before that in group 1, group 2, there is the ability of producing fever, even high fever, if it's necessary. In group 3 and group 4, this ability is lost, but not totally lost. This means in a life-threatening situation in group 3, you may find fever, like we see in NRSA infections. We see producing high fever. But this means that the input of the disease must be a very strong one and many times life-threatening. Now, regarding the situation in group 4, it means if a group 4 person will very rarely or at the end of his life, like we see in cancer cases, develop fever, this means that this fever always will be for life and death. This fever can carry the possibility, if you find the correct remedy, that you may improve the health of the patient, because we normally say group D, or as we call it also group 4, is incurable people. If somebody should develop fever in group 4, and you are one of the fantastic prescribers to find the remedy and follow with the next correct remedy, and you can cure and you can treat and cure the fever state, then there is a possibility for a better state for the patient. I don't say a cure, but he may develop into a higher level of health.
Great. Well, I see that we're finished with our hour. Again, I want to thank you, Dr. Kavoris, for doing a fantastic job. I'm excited personally to participate in one of your upcoming clinical seminars. They sound absolutely fascinating, and I'd like to learn from you personally. I'd like to unmute the lines, and if we can all give a very big thank you for taking the time out of his very busy schedule to join us, I think that would be just great.